We are back in the Gospel of Matthew. We had a couple weeks off through Easter, but we're going to pick up in chapter 9 this morning, where we left off a few Sundays ago. And just because it's been a little bit, and so we're out of Peter, I'm still having a hard time. Yeah, this is, did you see the pictures of the 55 plus event before service? They were on that pre-announcement loop. Peter was just all in a way that the rest of you should feel ashamed of yourself, because some of you did, you know, costumes for the night. Peter committed to the long haul. It's awesome and inspiring. One of these Sundays, you might arrive at church, and I'll have my hair looking all dark and dapper, but there's not enough of it to dye quite like yours. But anyway, sorry, that's an aside from Matthew. Although Peter shows up in our story today, so maybe not so far. But we are picking up Matthew chapter 9. So just the background, just so we're kind of on the same page, and we've talked about this a couple of times through the Gospel of Matthew, that the Old Testament background and sort of the foundation to the story of who Jesus is and God's incredible redemptive plan is critical for understanding how amazing a picture is being presented of Jesus. Like, we could read the Gospel minus any of that background, and I'm sure you would still leave going, wow, Jesus is amazing. He does amazing things. He says amazing things. But when you see what the Old Testament is doing, laying out sort of, you know, hundreds of years of God's redemptive plan, and then realize it is all coming to its pinnacle moment in Jesus, I hope just more than ever, your awe of Christ is increased as we think this whole thing through. So let me just take you back just for a minute, just a reminder, connect some dots all the way back. I'm going to take you to Deuteronomy 4, although there's certainly other places we could go. Deuteronomy 4 is just one of my favorites, because in Deuteronomy 4, we find out really the purpose, or we might put it like this, what is the vocation of Israel? Why has God chosen Israel? We might use phrases like this, that he chose them not because they were somehow uniquely qualified in their greatness or superiority or anything like that. In fact, Scripture tells us he chose them because they were the least. They were small, so that when he worked through them, it would be evident that it was him at work and not people. And he chose them to be a light to the nation. So their vocation was not just that the goodness of God would be poured on them for their own sake, but that they would also then reflect that to the nations. And in Deuteronomy 4, we get a great statement of how that's supposed to work. So if you were to jump in, I'll read a little passage here for you in verse 6. Now, bear in mind, I'm jumping in half stream here, as God has just explained to them the importance of obeying him. And I think the obedience always comes as an expression of trust. In other words, you will obey God when you trust him. If you don't trust him, you're not going to obey him. It's just that simple. But when we trust him and believe him to be good and wise, we will walk in step with what he said. So he's told Israel the importance of keeping his commands. Verse 6, he says, keep them, do them, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the people. So this is reflect the glory of God, reflect the goodness of God, be a light to the nations kind of language. And here's then what's supposed to happen with the peoples who see this. Goes on and says, who, when they hear all these statutes, will say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you today? In other words, the nations are going to see God at work among his people, and they're going to conclude two great things. One, God is near. Must be God drawing near. And two, what God has spoken to this people is wise and righteous. Those are going to be the two conclusions. So as you think through and start kind of walking through some of the Old Testament stories, you see this theme often surfacing, right? Of the nations kind of drawing near and seeing the presence of God and the wisdom of what he's had to say. When you get to the story of David, kind of the first picked king of Israel by God, this young man who, by the way, is, you know, chosen as this young shepherd and brought into the role to be the shepherd of the nation, not of sheep anymore, but of people. And we're told right in the middle of his story that God will one day raise up a king from David, a son of David, who will be king over his people forever. And he will rule with power and righteousness, and he will be the king forever. Of course, David has a son, even as you read through the story. Son of David, a man named Solomon. And as you read through Solomon's story, I think two things become really evident the way the story is told. One, he is wise, right? Maybe you've heard that of Solomon. He's the wisest man who ever lived. When asked by God, request one thing of me. What does he ask? The wisdom to rule his people well. And he's a king who seeks to draw near to God. He actually is the one who builds the temple. The two things of Deuteronomy 4 are kind of the two key issues of Solomon's life. And then just what you would expect, what does Deuteronomy 4 say is going to happen? When those two things are evident, God is drawing near, wisdom is there, what's going to happen? The nations are going to see. And right at the high point of Solomon's life, I'm pretty sure it's 1 Kings 10, but if I'm steering you astray, I apologize. Pretty sure though, 1 Kings 10, the Queen of Sheba comes, a very powerful woman, not a believer in God that we can understand from the story, but she hears of what? His wisdom, and that God has drawn near. And so she comes to visit. And she makes a statement in the middle of that story. She says, you know, I had heard of this. Now I've seen with my own eyes, and I realize I'd only heard the half of it. God is near. This is wisdom. This is exactly what's supposed to happen, that when God is there and the center of their world and their community, those would be the two things that would be evident to the world. And then you turn one page, 1 Kings 11, what happens next? Solomon turns from God, and it's disaster. And so it sets up the stage, looking still for the one who will be the son of David. Clearly, it's not Solomon. Yes, he is a son of David, but not the son of David who is promised. And through the rest of the Old Testament, you start to just continually see the prophets, the different historical books looking and saying, one day there will come one who is the true son of David. And what will happen? He will be wise, and it will be a moment when God draws near. Fast forward to Matthew. Matthew starts us out in chapter 1, verse 1, and says, I want to tell you the beginning of the story of Jesus Christ, the son of David. Interesting, right? What do we expect then to see in the story of Jesus? Should expect two things. We should expect to see God draw near, and we should expect to see unbelievable wisdom and righteousness. And so as we've walked through the story so far, the gospel that Matthew writes for us, we've seen those very things. It's not just that Jesus shows up and then God draws near. Jesus is God drawing near. And when he teaches, as we saw through chapter 5, 6, and 7, this first big sort of sermon that Jesus delivers, the teaching of the kingdom, you read it. And I would challenge you, if you've never read it, sit down, even maybe this afternoon. It's only a few pages long. Read it and see if it is not some of the most brilliant wisdom and righteousness you have ever laid eyes on. Because people, believers or not, who read the Sermon on the Mount say, that's actually one of the greatest, those who don't believe, they would actually look and say, that's one of the greatest pieces of literature ever put onto paper. God drawing near, infinite wisdom. Now, what should happen next? The nations should come. Right? That's sort of the expectation. And so we've been working through the next couple chapters where we see the great works of Jesus as he heals the sick and he restores sight and he does all these amazing things. And in verse 35, where Mercedes read for us of chapter 9, Jesus steps back for a minute. We get this sort of editorial comment that Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. It's an interesting little note, right? It's sort of the precursor of what's to come. Their synagogues. You notice that? Not our synagogues, not his synagogue, theirs. There's starting to be this separation between Jesus and what would be sort of the religious establishment of Israel, a little bit of a break. We're starting to see it happen. The Pharisees are opposing him. The crowds are amazed at him. But those who are in religious leadership are saying, no, we're not with this man. And so it's their synagogues, not our synagogues. And he's healing every disease and every affliction. And then verse 36, when he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. That is the motivation for ministry, for all of us. Don't just think of it like the church staff, we do ministry. It's as followers of Jesus, this is to be our motivation, each one of us, as we are involved in the world around us representing Jesus Christ, that we would see, like truly see. And there's a difference between seeing and seeing, right? We understand this. I know, even as I say it, I know you know what I mean. You can see someone walk by without actually really stopping to see them and consider what's happening in their world. Jesus does that. It's not just that he notices the crowds. He sees the crowds. What's really interesting is through Matthew's telling of the story of Jesus, there'll be three more times where the same phrase comes up that Jesus sees. It's going to show up in chapter 14, verse 14, 15, 32, and then my favorite actually in chapter 20, which is a fascinating little story of Jesus healing a blind man. Talk about ironic, right? He's going to come across a man who can't see but understands that Jesus is the Son of David and he will restore his sight. That is not ironic. If that's not significance to this whole situation, I don't know what is. But Jesus, in each case, when he sees, has compassion, and then every time does something, does some action to alleviate the very issue that led him to have compassion. So you can go and read all those stories. Jesus sees, feels compassion, and then does the necessary action. In this case, he sees this group of people who are like sheep without shepherds, and what's he going to do? He's going to send out his disciples. He's going to send out men who are going to represent him as shepherds to care for the lost sheep of Israel. We'll get to that in a moment. But I want to just make sure we understand that this motivation is not just Jesus' motivation. It's not just the 12 disciples' motivation. It's supposed to be ours. The call as followers of Jesus is to share in this motivation, that we would see the need of people, pay attention to them, not just pass by them quickly because it would be too much mess or too inconvenient to actually get involved, but we would actually stop and have compassion. Now, the word compassion is one of these great ones. It actually translates terribly into English, but it's kind of fun. It actually means your bowels are moved. Now, in our world, I'm wondering how that translates into Russian or Ukrainian, but in our world, we speak more of the heart as the seat of the emotions, right? It's like, I love you with all my heart. We don't mean like, I love you with this organ in here that's pumping blood. We're meaning something more profound, like kind of like with the core of our being. But in the ancient world, they spoke as the emotions are really in the gut or in the bowels. And so that's kind of the language that's being picked up when you're kind of like, right. And actually what's really interesting is I think it's probably actually more accurate. Have you ever had one of those moments where something happens? Maybe you come on a stage and you're like me, you don't like being in front of people, and your stomach just feels like, oh. We might call it butterflies, but you just don't quite feel very good. I remember years ago, like this going back, like before Lynn and I were married, we were still dating. It was a New Year's Eve. We were spending New Year's Eve with some good friends of ours, and we were driving. It was in Surrey, so it was dark and rainy. I said in the first service, because it's always dark and rainy in Surrey. But we were driving on this night and a dog ran out in front of the car. Sorry if this is triggering to anyone. The dog ran out in front of the car. We ran over the dog. I was in the passenger seat, just full disclosure. It was my best friend that did it. You actually could feel the dog under, I don't know, too much information, right? And we pull off to the side and this guy comes running out of the house and he's in tears. And I'll never forget. He's like, oh, Bo. And he comes and he grabs the dog and we're just standing there. And I felt sick. I mean, my stomach just was gross. That's the seat of emotion. Jesus sees this crowd of people and is so moved by what he sees. There's like something in his guts is moved. It's interesting that we would have that picture of Jesus. It's a weird picture, isn't it? You don't often think of maybe Jesus in those terms. But I don't think his compassion is just for Matthew 9. I think when he looks at us, and because of his great love for his people, when he sees your need, he's still moved to compassion. And what's true about Jesus when he's moved to compassion? When he's moved to compassion, he has moved to action. He has not forgotten you. You might be sitting here today going, well, I feel like he does not see my situation. I guarantee you he does. And it may well be that one day you will look back and realize, even as you're sitting there going, I don't see him working, that you'll realize he was even now already working to care for you. Now, in this situation, he brings another Old Testament reference. And this is, again, important so that we kind of see what he's doing through the stories. He doesn't just bring up this as a random picture of, oh, they're like sheep without a shepherd because we live in a place and there's sheep. And sometimes this is actually Old Testament. So if you go back to the Old Testament, the first king, David, literally is a shepherd. God raises him up to be king and calls him the shepherd over his people. Like that's going to be the paradigm for leadership within the nation of Israel, both politically and religiously. These men who are called to serve and to represent, you know, God within his nation are called to be shepherd leaders. They're to care for the sheep. And so all the way through the Old Testament, you'll see this language come up quite often. It's sometimes spoken of God, like Psalm 23, where the Lord is our shepherd, but then the representatives of God are to serve the people like shepherds. And when they fail, often the judgment or the condemnation is presented in shepherd language. So if you came to a place and all, you don't have to flip there, you could make a note and look later if you want. Ezekiel 34 is kind of one of the most famous passages of this, where God speaks through the prophet to the shepherds of Israel. These are the leaders, the religious leaders specifically of Israel. And this is kind of the flavor of the Old Testament. This isn't the only passage, but this is kind of typical. The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Not the people who are keeping sheep out in the fields. These are the religious leaders. Prophesy and say to them, thus says God, ah, shepherds of Israel who have been feeding yourselves, should not shepherds feed the sheep? You eat the fat, you clothe yourselves with wool, you slaughter the fat ones, but you do not feed the sheep. Now listen to this. This is so fascinating. The weak you have not strengthened, the sick you have not healed, the injured you have not bound up, the stray you have not brought back. What does Jesus do? He goes around seeking the lost, healing the sick, caring for the weak. Isn't it interesting that the very nature of the ministry that he has is the very ministry that the shepherds of the Old Testament are failing to execute on? And so it continues, and there's this great condemnation. The sheep are scattered. You're not feeding them. You're feeding yourselves. You're getting wealthy and fat off of the sheep when you're supposed to be caring for them. And so the whole point of Ezekiel 34 is God saying, because of this, you're fired. You're no longer going to be the shepherds of my sheep. Instead, I will set, and this is verse 23, I will set over them one shepherd, my servant David. Now, David has been dead for a long time at this point. It's not David, it's the one who will come, the son of David, who will come and, like his father David, rule well over the nation and rule forever. And it goes on and says, he will feed them and be their shepherd. Fast forward to Matthew chapter 9, Jesus looks out over this group of people and you start to realize what he's doing is condemning the religious leaders and helping us understand who he is. He looks out over them and says, these crowds that I see that I have compassion over are like sheep without a shepherd. That means the Pharisees, the religious leaders, are not doing what they're supposed to do. But he's about to step in and do it. In fact, he will often refer, even in those shepherding terms, John 10, many of us, it's one of our favorite passages, right? Jesus is the good shepherd who's going to lay down his life for his sheep. He's going to be the shepherd of Ezekiel 34. Now, he's going to enlist some help. And that's kind of where this next section is going to go. And if you were to look at chapter 10 and had a Bible with the red letters, like some of us do, that tell us those are the words of Jesus, you'll see almost the rest of the chapter is going to be Jesus speaking. And it's going to be a long teaching and instruction, first for the actual 12 disciples who are going to, they're about to be sent out to do something representing Jesus. And then midstream, he actually transitions from just those 12 then to speak, I believe, about all of his disciples to come forevermore. In other words, he's going to commission the 12 in a unique, particular way, but he also commissions each one of us. There's no such thing as a disciple of Jesus who isn't commissioned. That category doesn't exist. So if you know Jesus and you're following him, understand you are sent on mission. It's a given. You can't have Jesus and not have mission. It doesn't work like that in Christ's kingdom. And so he's going to give instructions. And our plan is this morning to get from where we're at now to about verse 16, kind of looking more at what does Jesus say, particularly to the disciples, because I think there's some things even in that apply to us. And then next week, we're going to pick up mid-talk of what Jesus is saying and look at what comes next, because he's going to anticipate some pretty important things. There's going to be persecution. This is not always going to be easy, and therefore we're going to need some instruction on how to have courage and confidence even when things are difficult. So that's a preview of next week. But he comes to his disciples, and you'll see it there in verse 37, the end of chapter 9, and he says, the harvest is plentiful. In other words, there's a huge crowd out there. Now he's going to switch analogies from sheep and shepherd. He's going to start talking farming. He's going to say, the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. And it's amazing to me, and I don't know that I fully understand it, that God, when he works, calls his people to work alongside of him. He doesn't need us. Even this story, realize for a second, Jesus didn't need 12 disciples to go out and do this. He was fully capable. He's all powerful. And yet he invites them in this amazing, amazing thing called his kingdom, where he invites us to pray and ask the Father to work. And then in answer to the prayer, and I don't know exactly how this next scene goes. I'll tell you what I have pictured, although I'm sure it's probably not accurate. Right? Jesus comes to the disciples and says, hey guys, we need to pray that my Father will send out workers into the fields. There's a lot of work to be done. So my picture is Peter's like, yes, we'll do it right now. Because that's Peter, right? It's like, yep, let's get on it. Pray. Let's cuddle here, guys. 12 of them get together. And Peter's like, you know, Lord, Jesus has told us we need to pray. Would you send out workers into the field? And then you open up to chapter 10. You realize the answer is right there in front of your eyes. Have you ever had that moment where you've prayed? It's like, Lord, would you please do something to work in this situation or help this person? And then you finish the prayer and you just realize the conviction in your heart is, oh, I'm the answer. God's not only calling us to pray, he's calling us to serve. So Jesus says to the disciples, pray that the Lord of the harvest would send out our laborers. In chapter 10, he turns around and says, oh, by the way, God's just answered, and I'm going to send you. Now, this is the first time where disciples ever been sent. Kind of a major moment in human history. Up to now, the language of discipleship is not unique to the New Testament. To be a disciple is to be a learner. And so in the ancient world, it'd be pretty conventional that you would have a teacher. The Jewish version of that would be called a rabbi. And you as a student might come to the rabbi and say, hey, could I be one of your students? The rabbi would never stoop, is how it would have been viewed, to go out and recruit their own students. You notice Jesus has already done that, right? The incredible humility, even though he is fully God and wise above any teacher, he actually goes out and says, follow me. He invites people to be his followers. He's still doing that to this day, by the way. All of us are here because we've been invited. But then he actually turns around and says, and now I'm going to send you. This is brand new. There's never been a teacher up to this point who gathers students around and then sends them out. It's like, no, everyone should come to the teacher, but Jesus is about to send them out. And the word shows up in chapter 10, verse 5, sent out, they're apostles. In the New Testament, we use that word in two ways. One is a particular way, as a almost like a title of these men who are uniquely qualified. You can read about that in Corinthians. Paul speaks a little bit of the unique qualifications. But then it's also used in a broader way in which everyone who is a follower of Jesus in that broader way is an apostle in the sense that we're all sent out. Not with the same kind of authority delegated to us that these men have. It's going to be a very unique situation. But certainly with the same kind of commission, the same kind of instruction to go out and obey Jesus in what he will call us to. So he calls these 12 to him, chapter 10, verse 5. We're finally up to chapter 10, which is really where the sermon starts. And he gave them authority. And again, sometimes I think we miss stuff of the subtle notes going on beneath the surface that help us understand how great Jesus is. How much authority does it take to be able to delegate authority to someone else to go out and heal? You see, verse 1, heal every disease. You fast forward a little bit and you see in verse 8 of what they're actually going to do. You just read it real quick. It's real fun. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse lepers, cast. Raise the dead. Well, represent me. I'm going to give you the authority as you go to raise the dead. We need to stop for a minute and just consider the kind of authority needed to be able to do that. That's amazing. We had a bunch of our medical church family in the first service, and so when I saw them, I used an example, and they all grinned at me. Said, if I showed up at the hospital and said, hey, I'm here to help out this afternoon. I hear things, you know, it's pretty busy. I hear sometimes we're short of staff, you know, short of doctors. So I'm going to volunteer. I think they're going to say no thank you. From the looks of the expressions on the various doctors and nurses in the first service, including Abby was great. I think it would be more than just, hey, no thanks. I think it would be probably like, hey, police department, would you come take this not away. You see, to be able to do that, you need a level of authority. I probably have to go to UBCO, go through a number of years of education, maybe 8, maybe 10, depending on what you're trying to do. Get some professional certification, pass some exams, have some sort of recognition before you can just show up and do that. In other words, there's a huge process to be delegated the kind of authority that it would take to have a role like that. And I guess I say that to ask you this question: what kind of authority is needed to be able to heal every disease and raise the dead? Because I don't even understand what category, I don't understand what school you could go to. There's just, you just realize it's just a totally different thing we're talking about here, and yet Jesus is just able to say to the 12, I'm going to send you out, and here's the authority you have. Now, the list is given of the 12. It's the first time Matthew actually gives us the full list. McCady's did a great job. We, every once in a while, do that to our interns. It's like, here, read scripture. It's going to have a whole bunch of really big names. She did stellar in that. And you see the list of the names there in verse 2. Goes through all 12. In the Greek, it shows up better than in the English, that they're actually given in pairs. Very likely, as you read through Mark's gospel, he's often sending them out in twos, which actually is probably a really good, wise principle. So he's going to send out his disciples, and he just goes through the list. He just tells us the list. Now, for us, we get used to the list of disciples, and we can probably start to think of them as pretty extraordinary men. And in time, they would be. Most of them would give their lives for their conviction of who Jesus is and would do amazing things on the way to that moment. At this point, they're just kind of ordinary guys. Very ordinary, in fact. In fact, not only are they ordinary, they're actually, in many regards, not even the kind of people you would typically think that someone would call to go and represent them. Some of the names are Greek. That's a curious detail of a people who are name your son after a Greek name. Probably says something about your background. Thomas, interesting name. It means twin. I don't know how that one went down, but I can just imagine in my mind's eye, like I remember having, you know, Linda's pregnant and you got, could be a girl, could be a boy. We were old school, so we didn't find out, right? So you got to have one of each name, right? So you got the names and then they're born and it's like, oh, so we're going to use the girl name or the boy name. You kind of imagine Thomas's mom, they give birth, and it's like, they use the name. And then the next one comes out, and it's like, oh, there's a second one. We don't have a name for you. We'll call you twin. I and it sounds silly, but I don't understand how else you would get there. Like, there's, and through this list, there's a variety of some pretty peculiar, you know, James. He's often known as James the Lesser. It actually means small. Hey, he's the little guy. I was never a big guy. I like to stand up on the stage. Adds to my 5 foot, almost 8. Yeah, but for many of us who never quite had the growth spurt that we dreamt of having, imagine going through the, hey, it's Don the little guy. And these are the disciples. Jesus gathered them around. Simon the Zealot. Zealots are a political slash, not quite sure the right, from the Roman perspective, they were terrorists. They were involved in guerrilla warfare. The time that is going on here, they had a very clear mandate that if you saw a Roman official, you were charged to assassinate them. Sort of meant to be a zealot. And Jesus is like, hey, you, Simon, you follow me. And oh, by the way, Matthew, you tax collector who actually is working for the Romans, you follow me too. And in this little group of 12 people, we're going to have two men who are on totally opposite teams. And Jesus gathers them together and says, these are going to be the 12, and I'm going to give you my authority to go and represent me, to be the ones who will be shepherds to the lost sheep of Israel. And he sends them out. And in the instructions from verse 5 to verse 16, he's going to deal with three big issues. Number one is sort of geographically where they're to go. And I think there's some implications to that. And number two is sort of the message and their activity that they're to carry out in going. And then three is kind of some of those practical details. It's like, well, how are they going to live? How are they going to fund this operation? And often even when we send out like our youth to Salt Spring, we, you know, make sure they have adequate money to get a bus to get there and have some food and all these kind of things. And so Jesus is going to deal with some of the logistics. And as he does, we'll see there's a few very important things. So first, where are they to go? Verse 5, go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans. So there it is. It's more of a prohibition than an instruction. Now, if you can kind of picture a map, you would know that Jesus at this point is in the northern part of Israel around the Sea of Galilee. To the north, west and east, it's all Gentile area. And so literally what he's just said to them, the literal translation is, don't go anywhere by the way of the Gentiles. So he's actually forbidden them to use certain roads. Can't use a Gentile road. Can't go north, east, or west. To the south is the Samaritans. You can kind of picture on a map. It's like, okay, now we know where we can't go. We can't leave this little area. That's kind of the description. So go nowhere among the Gentiles. Go nowhere in the Samaritans. You're going to stay in the villages around the Galilee area. That kind of gives you a bit of a geographic kind of scope of this thing. It's kind of interesting. And he explains why in verse 6, go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. In other words, he's saying this mission of the Old Testament is what we're carrying out right here. And if you go again to the Old Testament, you start looking for this kind of language, you'll see it pop up a number of times. It pops up in Isaiah, pops up in Jeremiah again, that there are this lost sheep of the house of Israel, and they need to be found, and the servant is going to be sent, the chosen one, the Messiah, is going to be sent. And what's his first priority? To this lost sheep of Israel. That's going to be plan one. And if you read through all of Isaiah, you'll discover a shocking thing as the book goes on, that when this servant comes and tries to bring people back to the light of Yahweh so that they then function as a nation to bring the nations to Yahweh, they don't. And so by chapter 49 of Isaiah, all of a sudden the servant is now turning his attention to the nations, saying, well, if Israel is not going to come to Yahweh, then we will expand this mission to the nations, and we will bring the nations to God. And you know the story. It's exactly what happens. Go read the story of Paul. Go read Acts. It's detail by detail, it's exactly what Isaiah says is going to happen. And now we're in the first stage of it where Jesus says, we're not going to the Gentiles. We're starting with the lost sheep of Israel, just as Isaiah said. So he sends them out. That's the plan. And they have a very simple missionary program. They're going to proclaim one message and carry out a number of actions. The message they're to proclaim is the kingdom of heaven is at hand. It's near. Remember what Deuteronomy says? The nations are going to see your wisdom, and they're going to see that God is near. Kingdom's near because the king is near. That's what's going on here. Jesus is drawing near to these people and now making sure that his disciples announce it. The king is near. We need to pay attention because he is God who is drawn near. They're to go with this message. By the way, don't think that the message needs to be changed. It doesn't. This is the one wonderful. We don't have to have like work groups. So like, you know, imagine if we were sending out a team, you know, Salt Spring Missions team. It's like, hey, we need to figure out what we should say. Let's gather together. We'll try to think up some message that we should communicate down to Salt Spring. It's like, no. Kingdom of heaven's at hand. God's near. He's come in the person of his son who died on a cross. And we can have confidence in that news. We don't have to figure out how to make it different or somehow what we might think as more compelling. Every time that has happened in the history of the church, we've gone off the rails. Message is wonderfully simple and true, and we can have confidence in it because God is the one who takes that message and transforms heart. It's not us. That's actually why we can be really liberated to share our faith, because God's going to be the one who takes that message that we proclaim and opens eyes and hearts to it. It's not us. I've had some funny experiences in life, like the times where I've really legitimately thought I did such a great job of sharing the gospel to people have been often the times where there was just no fruit. I remember talking to a man in a Chinese restaurant. I gave the best gospel presentation of my life. It was great. So clear, so compelling. I mean, I got to the end of it, and when I asked him the question, would you like to give your life to Jesus? I was 100% sure the answer was going to be yes. Actually, I was like thinking, it's like, here we are at the table and we're going to bow right here. It's going to happen right here. And he looks at me, he's like, no. Because it doesn't depend on me. I've had other moments, and I know I've told this story where I shared the gospel with another guy who became a lovely friend in time at a A&W restaurant. And I botched it so badly, made it so confusing that literally I didn't even ask him. And we get out in the pickup truck in the parking lot, and I literally said it like this. You don't want to receive Jesus, do you? Like, the answer is, of course not, because I don't even understand what you're talking about. And in tears, he's like, yes, can we pray right here? Like, we just proclaim the message. The Spirit of God is the one who works in the hearts of people. Jesus sends out his 12 saying, here's what you say. The kingdom is at hand. This has been the message of John the Baptist. It's been the message of Jesus. It's the message of the 12. It's our message. Just go out and communicate to people. The kingdom of God is near. It's drawn near. Can I tell you about Jesus and what it means that he drew near? They go out. That's the message. We need to go out and do the same. Lastly, is the instructions for what they're to take and how they're to navigate things. And you can read it all right there. It begins in verse 9. Don't have gold, silver. Like, you don't need a lot for this. There's a sense of urgency to this. And the whole point seems to be that as you go, there are going to be people who are going to take care of you. Right? And that's one of the joys we have as a church. We send out missionaries, and we have the opportunity of being a part of that. We actually are able to financially help so that people can just go and share the gospel, and we can kind of fill in some of those gaps. But you'll see also embedded in this, there's this sense that the character of the gospel should be appropriate to the conduct of Christ's people. And there's this little moment in here where he talks about, you know, give without pay. Why? Because the gospel is a free gift given. So how we live, how we conduct ourselves should be consistent. If our character is contrary to the gospel, we've got a problem. And if you're like me, every once in a while, you turn on TV. I don't have any sort of cable, but if I'm on holidays, I often look at those religious broadcasting things. Horrifying. Because the character is so contrary to the gospel. Like, it literally is horrifying that this is the message that we're communicating. It's like, send us 10 bucks and we'll send you. I've seen that. Like, we'll send you the special blessed scrap of fabric. I'm like, that is absolutely contrary to what Scripture is teaching us. It's a free gift. It's a wonderful gift. And so Jesus sends out his disciples and says, just have your character and your conduct match the message that you're going to proclaim, this free gift of salvation. Now, how does it work itself out? You'll see that in verse 12. As you enter a house, greet it, not the house, but the household, right? Greet the household. If the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. If it's not worthy, let your peace return to you. I love this little moment. What is worthiness? Does it mean like, hey, they are super rich and they're going to take care of it? No, it's like, just do they receive the message? The basis for worthiness is not that we are somehow inherently wonderful in and of ourselves. The basis of worthiness is simply, will I receive the message of Jesus? Isn't this awesome? That means anyone in that sense is qualified, because we all have nothing that we bring. Sometimes just in our heads, we think we're bringing a lot to the table. That's the only thing that makes us unworthy, unable to receive the message of the gospel, because we aren't recognizing that we are poor in spirit, able to receive the grace of Jesus. So he just says, go. If they receive it, stay there. I find that interesting. That's actually probably really wise. Means the disciples aren't going to be able to go, knock on a door, share the good news of Jesus, walk in, they receive it. It's sort of a humble little place. The meals aren't great. And they look across the street at this big fancy house. And it's like, let's go knock there. He's like, no, it's not how this operation's going to go. You're going to stay. You're going to allow them to care for you. But if they don't receive you, now we're up to verse 14. 14, 15, 16, real important here. We've got a few minutes, so we should be okay. If anyone will not receive you or listen to your word, shake off the dust from your feet when you leave that house or town. What on earth is going on here? Something very particular is happening here in this verse. Really important for us to understand. Jewish people would have understood exactly, and this would have horrified them. Okay, so if you're a Jewish person living at this time and you leave Jewish geography, and actually if you're living in the Galilee, you pretty much at some point are going to have to. You're surrounded by Gentile territory. The rest of the nation is separate in the south, in Judah, that other province. So if you walk into Gentile territory, you're now walking on unclean ground. And it's not just like about literally being dirty. It's just this recognition that the Gentiles are not clean. They're not part of the people of God. And so they are dirty. And so when I walk back onto Jewish soil, what do? I take off my sandals, I bang them together, the dust goes off, and I'm making a statement. Again, it's not about now my feet are clean. It's a statement of saying, I don't even want the dust of the dirty, unclean Gentiles to be brought with me back into the cleanliness of Israel. Okay, got the picture? That's what they actually literally are doing. But where have the disciples been sent? Remember where they're prohibited to go? Anywhere where the Gentiles would be. Okay, what's the implication? There should be no moment where they have to brush the dust off their sandals, because they're not going in an unclean place. And all of a sudden, probably, hopefully, the lights are going on. It's like, oh, so they're actually going to treat ethnically Jewish people like Gentiles. See what's about to happen here? Jesus is saying, and here's, I think, the point he's going to make that's going to become apparent. if people reject you and the message you bring about my kingdom, they are like Gentiles, not the children of Israel. In other words, the children of Israel are the people who trust me. That's a massive statement. I don't know how much you know some of the background and some of the complexities of this, but this is weighty stuff. Jesus is essentially saying the people of God are composed around their belief in me. Isn't that a massive thing to claim? You just imagine for a moment if you went to your small group this week, if you're in a small group or to your workplace and said, hey, by the way, the people of God are constituted by their orientation around me. If they believe in me, they're part of the people of God. If they don't, shake your feet off. It's unclean. They're out. Like, that is a massive claim of authority. And Jesus just unabashedly just throws it out there as the instruction to his disciples. And then adds this, verse 15. And this truly I say to you, this is Jesus' way of saying, pay very careful attention. I guess that's how I would translate it. Whenever he says, truly I say to you, it's like, pay attention to this. It will be more bearable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town. You go back and read Genesis. It's a horrifying, sinful situation that brings about the judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah. And Jesus is saying, that town that rejects me will face an even greater judgment. Again, you just start to consider the authority and the claim that Jesus is making. This is massive. Okay, one last verse, and then we'll be done. Verse 16. Behold, I'm sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Sheep are interesting. You know, there's no sports teams that I can think of that are the sheep. There's lions and raptors and... Can you imagine if your team was the sheep? It's like, wow, you're just like setting yourself. That's almost as bad as being Canucks, right? It's like, oh, it's just so painful. And I'm a Canucks fan. I know. I'm also a Jays fan. You know how they stagger the seasons like that? So just as your hope is being crushed in one sport, it's kind of like being awakened in the next. They do that to toy with us all year long. Jesus is saying a couple pretty important things here. Wouldn't you think? He's setting them up to actually have a realistic expectation. I'm going to send you out. Don't expect everything's going to just be easy. In fact, that's really where the instruction is going to go next. In light of the hostility that you're going to face for this, because I'm not just going to make sure everything is always simple and easy. In light of the hostility that you're going to face, you need to have some teaching. That's where we'll go next week. And you need to have some courage instilled in you. Otherwise, you're never going to make it because this is going to be hard. Because you're going to be like sheep in the midst of wolves. Our family watched this TV show. I don't know. I think it's still going on, called Alone. The whole premise is you send like a bunch of people. The first couple seasons were awesome because they were just average, ordinary people out into the wilderness, and they got like 10 items. And it was like, whoever can survive the longest, you win a bunch of money. As the seasons went on, they were all like special forces, and like they all ran their own outdoor schools, and it just felt less and less like real people. But there's always this epic moment, pretty much every season. Particularly the ones where they're like all super qualified and they've lived out in the wilderness for 8 months and done all these crazy, insane things. And they're in their little tent or under their little tarp, and all of a sudden you hear wolves howl. And I love it because they've got their own little camera, and you just watch the look on their eyes. Sheer terror. It's like there might be grizzlies walking around, that's kind of scary, but when the wolves start doing their thing, you know that's a dangerous spot. And Jesus says that's why I'm sending you out, like sheep, into the middle of a pack of wolves. So, in light of that, you need to consider two things. You need to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. And Emmanuel, don't ever separate those two. You see, if we just become as wise or as sort of shrewd as serpents, that's a picture. Serpents are shrewd, they're wise. If we become that, minus the innocence and purity of a dove, we will become cunning and deceptive, and we will do things to try to save our own skin and not represent Christ, and we will twist the message till it is hopelessly lost. That's what we'll do if we just are shrewd as serpents. But if we're just as innocent as doves, we will go out into this world and we will be naive, and we will be foolish, And so Jesus brings these two really interesting images together, and he says, here's what it's going to take. You're going to go out. It's going to be hard. Be both. Be both. Never compromise on your character. Never set aside integrity for some sort of gain or protection or safety. But in your courage, in your wisdom, oh, keep a soft, tender heart. I'm looking at so many of you because I know how you're living out your faith. It's a beautiful thing when it's done. Well done, Emmanuel. I really believe that. I think that's in many ways why God has been so good to work among us. Wisdom, because we're in a dangerous world. Purity, because it's our calling. Proclaiming the good news of Jesus' kingdom, because that's the only message we have that he has said he will work through. And we need to continue at it. Next week, we'll pick up. We'll see what Jesus has to say as we do that, of how we live our faith out in a very difficult situation with the courage that comes from knowing who God is.